I was a kid that went through a lot of bad stuff growing up, you know, being sexually abused and stuff, and being tossed from family to family. A kid that goes through that learns to lie, learns to read people, learns to say the right thing at the right time, because it's survival.
Welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hit Vice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover real revelations from some of professional wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host, JP Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator, Evan Husney, and also joining us once again, his fellow Dark Side co-creator, Jason Eisner, for this episode. Do not forget, Dark Side of the Ring continues Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice TV, with a look at really one of the greatest female wrestlers and managers of all time, the fiery and versatile, sensational Sherri Martel. It ends tragically, but what a run she had in the business, and going to be a look at all she contributed and created in the wrestling space coming up next on Vice. Evan, it's a heavy subject, Sherri Martel. It's definitely one where, you know, she was just so universally respected and beloved at a time when, you know, female representation was not what it is today in the wrestling business. She had to do it all. She took a lot of bumps. She absorbed a lot of pain. And I think the story will be laid bare for everybody coming up on Vice.
Yeah, that's right. This has been a long time in the making, this episode. Sherri Martel is someone that Jason and I have always been huge fans of ever since our childhood, you know, when she was alongside some of our favorites, like obviously with Macho Man Randy Savage. She was incredible. We've always heard so many amazing stories about her on our journeys across the country for this show over the past 7 years. And it's amazing to finally be able to do the episode. It's something we've always wanted to do, as I said. And it was great getting her family members involved. Her son is a big sort of standout character in this episode, as well as a lot of her peers. And I can even remember going back to season one, which we'll be talking about today, when we were making the Fabulous Moolah episode. There was a lot of stuff about Sherri we learned back then, and saw the potential for it to be an episode. You know, it took us this long to get there, but we did, and I'm so glad that we did, because she definitely is deserving of, you know, her just, you know, any chance we can spotlight her wrestling career, which kind of gets overshadowed a lot by her managerial career, but her in-ring career is incredible. And so, yeah, I'm really excited for people to check that out. And of course, one fact people may not know, unless they know a lot about Sherri's story, is that she and Jake Roberts, who we'll be talking about tonight, were, you know, dated for a very long time and were longtime friends. And so that's kind of why, you know, tonight is the perfect pairing. And Jake kind of gets into that and gets into their, you know, early days of their relationship, breaking into the business together and so on and so forth. And so it's a very emotional episode for him. He made quite the scene at her funeral, if you've heard those stories. But he had a lot to reflect on in terms of this episode. And so I thought it'd be good to pair tonight's dive into season one with Jake with, you know, season five, Sherri Martel.
Yeah. So even more to come from one of the most, you know, eloquent, who knows, you know, half the time what Jake's getting across in terms of the veracity of what he's saying, but just lie to me, Jake, you know, just whatever, just let me hear that poetry.
And, yes. Lie to me.
I would say this. There's more honesty in Jake's dishonesty.
Well said.
We talk about him all the time on the Lapsed Fan as somebody that elevated the art of the promo, the art of being a wordsmith, to a level almost no one else has ever achieved in wrestling. And of course, his demons kept him out of perhaps, you know, the top earning years he could have realized and the full glory that he probably deserved considering his talents in the wrestling business. We'll get into all that here on this episode of Unheard. You mentioned the connection with Sherri. Also, when you think about Sensational Sherri in the World Wrestling Federation, you immediately think of her role in the Macho Man Randy Savage's transition to the Macho King heel character, and then, of course, the reuniting of Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth in an unforgettable scene in 1991, and Sherri was the key catalyst there, being the one that was, you know, slapping Savage for losing to Ultimate Warrior, setting up Elizabeth, running in and throwing her down. So an absolutely vital part some of the most memorable stuff WWE's ever done. And when we think about that, we think about Jake Roberts and Randy Savage. That was a key point of focus on season one of Dark Side of the Ring when you guys looked at the history, the relationship between Randy Savage and Elizabeth and the role that Jake Roberts played as a heel, you know, sicking the snake on a tied up Randy Savage so he could bite his arm. All this just totally golden comfort zone stuff here. So Jake is the subject of endless fascination. And Jason, I know that the time you've spent with Jake Roberts over the years for Dark Side has been significant to you and really resonant. Just talk to us about why Jake stands out amongst everyone we've spoken to and heard from over the years.
Like when people ask me, like, who is my favorite wrestler? I've always said it's Jake the Snake Roberts. Ever since like I was a kid, I can remember like he like legitimized like wrestling so much, especially in the time period where I grew up with it, like in the 80s where, you know, it like wrestling kind of had like it leaned into like more like a comic book cartoon, you know, like kids. Like friendly product, but like Jake amongst like all these like over the top like characters kind of like leveled it out in a way or made it feel even more serious. And I knew as a kid, like watching him, that there was something about him that was like different than every other like wrestler. And yeah, I still to this day, if there's like a new Jake action figure, I'll pick it up. Cause I just, yeah, I love him so much. And so for us, like I've always wanted to work with him. Like even on my first feature film that I made, called Hobo with a Shotgun, I had tried to get him to play the villain in the movie, to play opposite Rutger Hauer. And it didn't work out. Like, I think at the time he wasn't able to like get into Canada. I even a couple years after I had like emailed him again and he was sorry it couldn't work out. But I remember Evan and I, we were at the Sundance Film Festival one year and we got invited to go to this there was a screening for the documentary about his life at a Slam Dance. And so Evan and I, we went up there, we watched the movie. It was a very emotional experience.
Pre-Dark Side of the Ring. This is years before Dark Side of the Ring.
Yeah. We haven't even like come up, like Evan and I really wanted to do something about wrestling at the time. We were thinking of like narrative films. But we went to the screening. There we actually met Scott Hall. And I remember we like walked down the street with him and that was really cool. And then we got invited to go to a Royal Rumble party where the guys were watching the Rumble.
This is the best.
And they were there with they were at the screening with it was Jake and Scott Hall and DDP.
Yeah.
And like the next day they're having the party at like one of the cabins that they're staying at. And so we go up and Evan and I, we're fully marked out at this time. Like we're wearing our Zuba pants and like, I think we had like WWF hats and
it was brutal.
And we like showed up and Jake like takes one look at us and he's like, "Oh, I just took off my Zubas like 10 minutes ago."
No, he took one look at me walking in the room with the Zubas on. And he's like, "God damn, I just took mine off 5 minutes ago."
and it was really cool because like we sat there and we just got a commentary from Jake and Scott. And it was really like hilarious. And
they were watching the Rumble. Sorry to cut you off. They were watching the Rumble and it was my first experience being with wrestlers watching wrestling, which is it should be its own show. Because literally they're watching this modern fucking Royal Rumble and just tearing it to shreds. They're watching it like, "That sucked. Look at that bullshit." You know, every move they're just tearing apart. And it was the best Rumble experience I ever had. And I'm looking over my shoulder being like, "Well, wait a minute. DDP was here yesterday. Where is DDP?" And then all of a sudden it was like, "Entrant number 17, Diamond Dallas Page." Like the goddamn guy took a red eye out to the fucking Rumble and somehow was here yesterday and now he's on our TV screen. And so it was this magical moment I just remember of watching the Rumble with them, kind of bonding with Jake and Scott, you know, pre-Dark Side, and then just picking their brains. And they were just telling us these stories one after the other. Jake was telling us a story. Scott was telling us a story. And we were just like, "Holy shit, man, this is like something. I don't know what it is, but it's something."
Yeah, like you remember, like Jake, like told that story where, like, he said that the wrestlers got like pimped out to fans and
female fans. Yeah.
Yeah, and we were like, "Whoa, really?" Like, that was kind of one of the first times I remember thinking like that.
Do you remember
like
what
a
he
side
said?
Of wrestling I've never heard. I don't remember the exact words.
He goes, he was telling us about how he would get, I can't remember which promoter it was or which territory at the time, but he would get pimped out, or he was saying he would, to the women in the front row. Like, they would make them sleep with the women in the front row because someone's got to keep them screaming.
Oh my God, help us. Hey, look, if you're going to twist my arm, right?
Yeah. So it was like, holy shit, this world is crazy and we got to get in there.
That was definitely one of the first kind of light bulbs for Evan and I. And then years later, like, you know, thankfully, because we had that like connection and we were, you know, working on other episodes for the first season of Dark Side of the Ring. And we thought, you know, for the episode about Macho Man, Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth, like, it would be great to like have Jake, you know, in part of the documentary, because he was a big part of their like storyline and one of the most infamous moments of like in wrestling, and especially in my childhood, is when Jake the Snake Roberts put the Cobra Snake to Randy Savage, was like so scarring to me as a kid. So, you know, it was a dream to get him. And I remember going to Vegas to interview him. And it was like so hot. It was like, I think, the hottest temperature I've ever been in. And with Jake, like, you had to like take breaks like every like 15 minutes. And so he could like have a smoke and just kind of cool off. And so we'd go outside, and I was smoking at this time. And so we'd take our shirts off and have smoked cigarettes. And
you guys were like that Brutus Beefcake Greg Valentine photo that's circulated. I'd go outside and it would just be surreal to me, you know, growing up as a fan, and here we are making the show, and here are you two fucking guys with both your shirts off outside smoking cigarettes, talking about, who knows, fishermen and fucking Nova Scotia or some shit.
Hey, Jason, somebody's got to keep him screaming, right?
Oh, man, that's right. That's right. And it was great. It was so awesome, because that ditto for me with the snake moment with Randy Savage. Also, the earthquake moment, shout out, John Tenta episode. But knowing that, like, we weren't sure how the show was going to come together yet. This is season one. You know, we loved Macho Man Randy Savage. If you probably pulled me back then, and when we were shooting this in 2018, I'd probably tell you that, you know, Randy Savage is my favorite wrestler of all time. Still might be, even though I've said Terry Funk on this very program. But Randy Savage was one of my favorites of all time. And we wanted to find a way to examine that world. And we just loved all those moments you were talking about, you know, with Miss Elizabeth reuniting with Randy Savage being one of the most emotional, amazing moments ever in wrestling history. And it's just getting swept up into that and wanting to show wanting non-wrestling fan audiences to feel that same thing that we felt when we were kids, you know. And that was a big reason to do this episode, was to go back and, you know, relive all that stuff and then kind of separate, you know, fact from fiction, show the blurred lines between reality and fiction, what's happening on screen and behind the cameras and how they are kind of interconnected. And that was kind of the whole idea. And then obviously Jake is just, you know, he's right there in the middle of it. So, yeah.
I love that you show the person who's wearing glasses and that bizarre hat crying, bouncing up and down. Because the person has like always been like legendary in my mind because I watched WrestleMania 7 so many times. But I love that you guys put that person in there.
Totally. We always love, you know, finding those moments of the crowd reactions in the archive footage, because it adds so much. I mean, when you see these, you know, dorky kids, you know, being swept up into this, and there's something so, you know, adorable and amazing about that, and so iconic about these moments too. And one last thing about Jake before we get to the show. I think kind of commenting on what you were saying, Jason, about just Jake the Snake, for me, it was like the word authentic, you know, comes to mind, authenticity, looking at the wrestlers of that time period, as much as I love Randy and as much as I love a lot of the other folks at that time, they were cartoon characters. You know, this is right in the era of, you know, 80s action figure, Saturday morning cartoon overload. But at the same time, Jake is someone that whose authenticity, you know, leapt through the screen at you and captivated you, because you could tell that this guy wasn't no gimmick. You know, he was this real grizzled, just intense, softly spoken, poetic sort of voice. And you can't cast somebody in that role like how wrestlers are today. I mean, a lot of wrestlers are cast into gimmicks and they're, you know, or they're just their regular shoot names. You know, this guy, you can tell, you know, he's got the beer gut and the mustache and he's traveled some fucking roads and he's seen some shit, you know, and he wears it on his face and he wears it everywhere. And it added so much weight to that character and who he was. And he brought so much of himself to it as well, too.
And he's such a great storyteller. Whenever you see a shoot interview with him, like the way he tells stories are so vivid and paint pictures. And he is poetic in that way too. And there's always like, I think like every trailer we've ever had for Dark Side of the Ring has like a quote from Jake. Cause it's just like, he's able to just kind of distill it down to a quick sound bite that just sounds great. He's the best.
In this interview, we're excerpting from his sit down session with you guys for the aforementioned Randy Savage Elizabeth episode. He sat for Dark Side cameras more times than that. The Gino Hernandez episode, of course, the episode you did on his family and that difficult dynamic coming up as children of Grizzly Smith. All of that stuff is wonderful, different glimpses into Jake Roberts. Well, one thing he did tell you, and upon your first sitting down with him, was a sort of a journey through his highs and lows. It really tries to home in on what the contributing factors are to both his highs and lows, not only in the wrestling ring and on camera, but in his troubled personal life, and how the contributing factors to his highs and lows are often the same. Here, Jake Roberts gives you guys a glimpse of where he draws all of these remarkable characteristics we've been talking about from.
I wish I could tell you it was a process. For me, it never was. Somehow in my head, I flip a light switch and I'm on. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to, should I do it this way or should I do it that way? To me, there's only one way to do it, the right way. And I used to think that everybody thought like I did, but they don't. And, Vince gave me the greatest compliment anybody could ever get from Vince McMahon. He said, Jake Roberts is the only guy I'm scared of because of his mind. Because I could sort things out and I could make it believable. And that's the key, making it believable. Now, I've got a theory on that too, but I really don't want to get into it, you know, because it deals with a dark time in my life. You know, I was a kid that, well, I'll go ahead and tell you. I was a kid that went through a lot of bad stuff growing up. You know, being sexually abused and stuff, and being tossed from family to family. A kid that goes through that learns to lie, learns to read people, learns to say the right thing at the right time, because it's survival. And I think that helped me become what I was and helped me make it believable. Because I'd spent my whole life doing it. I think that's one of the things that hurts wrestling today is that the guys don't have the time available to them to really become that character, to understand their character, to go out and put it to work and try it different ways till they get it right. Now they're, you know, it's a cookie cutter, man, stamped out the door. Come on, your main event this week, you know, on Raw. You know, and it's either shit or get out the pot. And it shows. You know, these guys aren't, they're not learning their art. And it's a lot of pressure and it's a lot of injuries and shorter careers for these guys. That's all I got.
JP, we've spent a lot of time on Lapsed Fan, kind of gritting our teeth at the harsh lessons that Jake Roberts is teaching us about the realities of what it takes to be a professional wrestler, how duplicitous you have to be, how able you have to be to convince people that you're being genuine to them and then present a completely different face to the next person and have them also believe that you're being genuine to them. Jake is the master. When you hear that, when you hear him talking about lying to survive, I'm sure it electrifies you, but tell us why.
I don't even know where to begin because it's
like gospel, the gospel of kayfabe.
Honestly, he's like reciting like wrestling Bible right there. You know, he's doing a fucking scripture reading and the lying to survive. Like, can you imagine, you know, there's so much about these guys and Jake specifically that when you really think about it on a genuine human level, it's awful what they go through. I reference the Savage episode. The fact that Jake more or less voluntarily, supposedly, he says he let a cobra bite him to prove that to Savage that the snake was fixed. Who does that? It's like, no, I'm not going to do that, you know, but he did it. You know, when we do Lapsed Fan shows that have Jake on it, I just record the, you know, when I'm doing sound bites, I just record the whole thing because I know it's going to be money and I know I'm going to use it because it needs to be heard because he had a way of, and it goes, it's all about that line to survive because you're desperate. You're desperate to make people believe. You're desperate to get to the next moment. You're desperate to go from point A to point B, and then you're desperate to go from point B to point C. And that's what he brought to wrestling. You know, that's what he brought in that whole thing was an odd sense of desperation to be believed so he could go on and do it again.
Yeah, and just mastering it. Mastering how totally. To do it.
Oh, my God. He's a poet. He's a fucking poet.
In shorthand, it's in-ring body language. It's not just verbosity. So, Evan, I mean, you guys are sitting there, and he's regaling you guys. And like Jason said, unlike many in the business, you are absolutely sitting across the table from Jake the Snake Roberts here. He is living it. He's talking about how hard it is for the guys today to live it the way he lived it.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that, you know, as I'm hearing that back and, of course, recalling the moment... but like when I do hear that, I often think, and I have before, if things would have wound up a little bit different for Jake, you know, if he wasn't sort of grandfathered into the wrestling business, what would he have been like as an actor, you know, for the screen? You know, what would he really is probably one of a very few, I think, in wrestling who is like the method wrestler, you know, like he really has lived so much life and so, you know, so much trauma and darkness, and he comes from darkness, but he harnesses it and he embodies it and he brings it to this often goofy business, you know, let's be real. And then he makes it fucking legit. Like he brings legitimacy in wheelbarrow loads, you know, he's just like, because when you see a lot of the wrestlers, and man, we have endless hours of tape of wrestlers dunking on modern wrestling. We probably half the tape we didn't use for the show is probably that. But it's like they don't make people like this anymore. You know, they don't make people who have walked in the shoes that Jake walked in. You know, it's not often that you get somebody who's had those same experiences. And so it's like you can't even compete as a modern wrestler, you know, because you grow up a fan of wrestling, and you're a fan and you want to get into the business that you have passion for, and you know you have all your favorites and everything. It's just a different entry point. Like the last thing he might wanted to do was become a wrestler, but like it's the only thing he could probably do, you know. And so given his circumstances, and so he just brings in so much of this lived in authenticity that just not many others are bringing to the table, you know, in wrestling.
I mean, they can't in a way because they haven't lived like this. You know, I think of it, you look at so many in not only just wrestlers, but you look at some great actors and it's almost like you really can't be on a certain level unless you've lived through a shit ton of trauma.
Yeah.
to like kind of to be able to build from, and he does that. It's sad in so many ways, but it's also amazing that he's able to kind of laser point it through his wrestling character.
Yeah, like I find like sadness in that lying to survive, like, quote. And, you know, because he's had to learn to, like, he's had to work people since he was a kid and through his whole life. And even as an adult, through his addictions, like, he's had to work, you know, people into thinking another sort of like reality. But gosh, it is like sometimes like the best performers are the people that do have like those like kind of traumas and are able to channel it into their art. And yeah, it's a tough thing, like, you know, like to find, like, I don't think like the wrestling world is conditioned, you know, now to like have those kinds of people in the sport. But yeah,
he brings a soul to it, you know what I'm saying? Like, where, you know, wrestling, you know, sometimes it's just, especially nowadays, I hate to keep saying it, but like, it's wrestlers, performers reciting somebody else's lines. It's like really hard to watch, you know, but this is so lived in, and he brings a soul to this, you know, very carnival, you know, atmosphere that is based upon that. But yeah, I mean, you can tell spending time with Jake, the weight of, you know, his soul is intense, but it doesn't mean that, you know, he's always 100% truthful. And I think that comes from his experiences of what he's had to do to survive.
Yeah. And make sure that, you know, if he's going to take the time to open his mouth, that you remember what he said. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's on a wrestling show or not. It doesn't matter if you see him on the sidewalk and it's a one-to-one interaction. This guy's going to make sure that you absorb. And look, you guys recalled two or three things he said in this impromptu Royal Rumble party you went to. That's his life's work in so many ways. And it's like you hear a, you know, it's the difference between hearing a modern day actor who's on the latest hit Netflix streaming show being interviewed on a red carpet and the kind of, you know, banal way they talk now versus an interview with a jazz musician from the 40s. You know, that's Jake Roberts.
Or a country or an outlaw country star, you know.
Yeah, that might even be more apropos. But what's interesting, you know, about Jake in so many ways, we've mentioned already, of course, son of Aurelian Smith, Grizzly Smith, who was a big-time wrestling star in his day, and you guys chronicled that so well in a future season of Dark Side of the Ring. Most know Jake Roberts, of course, from the snake gimmick, which Vince McMahon Jr. gave him upon signing him during Vince's national expansion in the mid-80s. But before that, Jake was making his bones as, you know, Jake the Snake Roberts in George Championship Wrestling without a snake or anything like that. I mean, he carried himself like a slithering snake, and he talked in very calculating tones, but he didn't have an actual reptile on his person. But George Championship Wrestling, TBS, Ole Anderson booking, Grizzly Smith helping, Jake Roberts involved. And he kind of, Vince McMahon came to Jake Roberts' doorstep in an unexpected and not really an appreciated way in 1984. It speaks to where we're going this season on Dark Side of the Ring. The final episode of the season will be about something called Black Saturday, the day in 1984 when Vince McMahon Jr. bought Georgia Championship Wrestling and showed up on that vaunted Southern wrestling-style television show. The last thing they want to see was Vince McMahon, and there he was, sort of one of his first full-sale takeovers. What a lot of people, I don't think, know, and what Jake Roberts talked to you guys about when you sat down with him for season one, was that Jake Roberts was essentially a booker for Georgia Championship Wrestling when Black Saturday went down. He was helping arrange talent, arrange matches and things like that, and he was on roster. And he learned quite a lesson about the guy who would give him the gimmick we all remember to this day and what he was about to do in the wrestling scene.
We just walked in and said, hey, we just bought this, that's ours, and you'll be getting papers and this, that, and the other. Some of you are going to be hired, some of you are not going to be. And I was just blown away that it just happened right before I'm fixing to shoot my television show. And I flipped, man. I cursed them out and tore up my booking papers and threw them in there. And I said, you'll need to put that back together so you can find out where the hell I was going. And I walked out. Damn, what a friggin' idiot I was, you know. And, you know, in those days, man, everybody was kind of trying to rally the NWA, if you will, and trying to keep guys because they seen what was coming. The promoters did. I was still blind to it. I couldn't see how that was really going to work. I didn't realize how much money was behind it and how serious it was. So I walked out.
Yeah, the business Jake learned and thrived in before Vince remade what the business kind of was and what it emphasized was disappearing before his eyes, and he was perfecting so many parts of his game. He tells you guys it was actually WWF Booker at the time, George Scott, who came to the TBS studios and made the announcement, very similar to how WCW was taken over in 2001 by the WWE when Shane McMahon and some of his lieutenants show up at a Nitro and just start telling everybody that we own this place now. And Jake was on the receiving end of that, and within a year is coming to work for Vince McMahon. Evan, of course, Black Saturday, something that obviously we've talked about, intrigued you guys quite a bit. And here is one of the all-time greats caught in the crosshairs.
That's wild to hear because, man, I don't remember that, you know, asking him about that or anything from that interview. And that's pretty interesting that if I would have recalled that, we would have called him up to be in the Black Saturday episode. God damn it.
He can be in every show. I mean, he could. Can't blame you for that. He can't be in every episode.
That's true. But he really could, you know, but he, yeah. And I don't want to blow his spot or anything, but these days he's got a limit, you know, in terms of how much time he's willing to give you and how much time he can handle sitting for an interview and so on and so forth. And, you know, every time, you know, we wrap it up, they are short interviews, but hey, man, he nails it every time, and everything that he gives us, we use. But, you know, absolutely 100%, I could see him in any episode just because, you know, he knows how to deliver those lines. Like a Jim Cornette, too, you know, who's also featured so heavily in our show, mainly because they're great talkers. And great talkers you need for television. You just do.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's so great about these earlier Jake interviews you did in particular is that he still, you know, he doesn't have endless endurance, but it's before you see, like, the oxygen tubes in his nose and some of the other health challenges. So he's much more sort of vivid, you know, in terms of what he's conveying. So that's kind of Jake Roberts' entree into realizing that the wrestling business that he was mastering was changing, and that going to work for Vince McMahon was certainly advisable if he was interested in you. And in short order, Jake would come to the WWF in 1985. And of course, it's the WWF where he gets the snake gimmick, and the idea of actually carrying this reptile around with him is something Jake gets asked about most often because it's such a fascinating and weird thing to wrestling fans that he was responsible for the snake.
You know, we tried to get snakes for the show to do the reenactments, and it was like impossible to find snakes that are like the size of the snakes that he had. And so, like, after us, like, trying, I can't imagine, like, where you would have to go to, like, to find them.
Dark corners, it sounds like.
I forget how we were going to try and incorporate it, but we actually filmed Jake doing, like, one of his stand-up sets at a comedy club.
Can I tell this? I remember it so well. I know where you're going with this, I'm pretty sure. Because it is it's the craziest fucking story. And when we were going to do this episode tonight, I was like, oh, I got to find a spot for this. When we were doing this interview, there was one sort of caveat that Jake had of, like, stuff that he will not talk about, which was stuff that that would be covered in his stand-up show. Okay. So we couldn't cannibalize his stand-up show. But now it's been, God, what, 6-7 years? We can do it. So the story that he told when he was doing his stand-up was so, again, I don't know how much of this is exaggerated or what for the stage, but it's, you know, imagine the Jake Roberts biopic and this being a scene in it. So he's telling us about how presumably around this time when he's switching out snakes, he is on the road, he's got a snake, and I don't know where he is in the U.S., but it's winter time and it's freezing, it's cold. And, you know, he's partying with some other wrestler. I think it might have been Valentine, maybe. And they pull off, you know, to a motel, you know, a motor lodge of some kind. And, when they wake up the next day, the next morning, they realize, oh, shit, fuck, we forgot to bring in the snake, you know. So they forgot to bring in the snake. They go out to the car and they open the trunk. And inside, the snake is frozen in a straight, stiff line. I don't know if that's what happens when snakes freeze, but that's what happened.
What would Jake Roberts know about a straight, stiff line?
Jesus Christ.
Hey-o.
Yeah-yo.
So anyway, he's got the snake there, and they thaw it out, and he had to wrestle that night. They had to get to the fucking arena, and there's no time to get another snake. And I think maybe he made some phone calls, and all they had were gardener snakes, and the pet stores couldn't supply the
He called the same plays as you guys did, probably.
Probably, because that's what we got fucking stuck with, was the gardener snakes. But anyway, he's got to bring it to the show, and it thaws out. And I mean, it's not living. And he wrestles, you know, he's got a match, and he's in the ring, and he's puppeting the fuck out of that thing and making people believe it's real. He's got the snake almost biting him. He's got the snake biting the guy, you know. And then after the matches, the people are like, you know, the boys in the back are like, holy shit, man, where'd you get that snake? That snake was fucking crazy, you know. And so he was thinking like, oh, man, this might be the way to go. Who needs a real snake when you can just puppet the snake you want, because it can be so unpredictable, right? So he's bringing this dead snake around with him for the whole week, you know, on the circuit. And then apparently, as the story goes, one night he's in the middle of the ring and he brings out the dead snake. And then he hears a gasp from the audience. And apparently it just split in two right in the middle of the ring.
He's like hanging on to either end of like the snake.
Yeah. This is like absolutely gross.
And you know, that's just another night on the road for Jake. You know, and it's like, Jesus.
And like the Christ. Smell being unbearable and everyone in the audience just being so disgusted. God. Yeah.
Well, let's take this to an even weirder place. What do you say?
Yeah, let's go.
Jake, of course, talked to you guys about that famous angle, and infamous, we should say, 92, where he ties Randy Savage up in the
91.
Ropes. 91, that's right. And he ties Randy Savage up in the ropes on Superstars and has the snake bite him in the arm. And you guys do a great job on the episode kind of talking about that and how that all went down and how, you know, Randy made, as JP alluded to, Jake prove in the locker room that the snake wasn't venomous by allowing the snake to bite him. And Jake does it almost like pissed off, like Archie Bunker doing it, like, Jesus Christ, I got to do. But anyway, Jake, you know, he's watched that tape back several times, and it's not for the reason you would think.
I remember this.
You know where this is going.
I forgot about this.
Serves a particular function for the snake man.
I'll be straight up with you, man. If ever I'm in a situation, if I'm having a hard time achieving wood or something, if I'm with a girl, all I gotta do is pop that video in, man, watch a couple of minutes of that, and I'm ready to go, man. It gets me pretty excited. Oh my God. It was a moment that will forever last. I mean, you can't go any further, well, unless you kill somebody. You know, maybe that's next, who knows?
God. Did you guys ever, you and Randy, talk about it afterwards?
We laughed about it. Brother, it's pretty fucking awesome, you know? Then Randy convinced himself that he was getting sick. Then he winds up getting a staph infection. So his arm blows up, and he's like, God damn that fucking snake, look at this fucking shit, man. So he, in his own mind, convinced himself that fucking snake had done that. Well, it wasn't the fucking snake that did that, Randy. You don't get staff from a snake. You get staff from dirt.
Did I hear somewhere that the snake actually like died days later?
Yeah, about 10 days later, the snake died.
Wow.
Fucking Christ.
If the snake died, maybe Savage wasn't fixed. Did anyone think about that? Maybe Savage had poison in him.
It could have been. I mean,
I got the poison inside me. I'm doing it. I'm getting it done.
Seriously, no, guys, like for real, like we could have done an entire hour on that angle and that just been an hour of television, because I do remember that. Like, I remember we were telling people about that. Like, man, he watches this as like a, you know, like, you know, Viagra or something. I remember we were telling people that for a long time.
Oh my God. He goes from that
to snuff killing film somebody next.
I mean, right, JP? One of the things he said turns me on. Remember how he was like cutting those super creepy promos about punching Elizabeth in the face?
Yeah. No, after the Tuesday in Texas match, he cuts that promo when he talks about how it turned him on to slap Elizabeth. And I guess it turns him on to watch Savage get bitten with a snake.
Well, he didn't say turned on, just it helps him achieve wood. I mean, let's not mischaracterize what the guy said. I'm just kidding, of course. Wow, this guy, man, you just turn the fucking microphone on. You know what I mean?
Just hit record.
So there's a lot of great stuff with him, you know, sort of describing going on the road while feuding with Randy Savage and being witness, like so many were at the time, to the unique dynamic between Randy Savage and his wife, Elizabeth, and how intensely protective Randy Savage was about his wife around, you know, a crew of wrestlers that were rather, you know, notorious for off-color behavior and for hitting on every woman they saw. And Randy wanted Elizabeth close so that, you know, he could sort of have a sense of what was going on with her. But at the same time, that requires having her around pro wrestlers. And on a particular road trip, Jake's in the car, as well as one of the great managers of all time, Bobby the Brain Heenan. And here, Jake Roberts tells you guys a story about how Heenan's quick nature calling moment leads to some more tension between Elizabeth and Randy Savage.
The one time that we rode together, it was Elizabeth and Randy in the front seat and myself and Bobby Heenan in the back seat. And we were doing a double shot, and we'd already wrestled once. I believe it was in Washington or someplace, and we were going to another show, and we'd had a few beers, you know, and we needed to use a restroom. So Randy just pulled over, and we got out and used the restroom, and Randy took offense to Bobby Heenan, where Bobby stood to take a leak, you know. I guess he looked up in the rearview mirror and seen Bobby standing there with his dangling, and he got back in the car, and Randy went off on him, man. I thought he was coming into the back seat, you know. Accused him of exposing himself to his wife, you piece of crap, you know, and really went off on him big time. I thought he was going to punch him. It was bad.
Was the rest of that ride, like, pretty uncomfortable?
Yeah. Yeah. Not for me, but Bobby, I made sure I didn't have to piss.
Heenan, what are you doing out there? You're showing your cock to Elizabeth. I can't have that. I see what's going on in your eyes, Heenan. I get it. I see where you're at. And I'm going to show you where the macho man is at.
Ah! You know where he is. He's in the back seat.
That's right.
How money is it that it's Bobby Heenan? You picture Bobby Heenan's incredulous face, you know?
I imagine, like, looking every which way and, like, trying to find a way out. As soon as he can.
Yeah, right, exactly.
He's unbelievable. So, you know, since Jake is going to go ahead and mention achieving wood, I mean, girls were clearly a thing for the Snake Man. He never hit it, you know. Old-time WWF fans remember his wife Cheryl actually airbrushed onto Rick Rude's tights for an angle at the time, red-hot angle at the time. And so, you know, Jake being a married man, that actually... kind of a rarity, that was part of WWF television storyline. Like, you knew as a fan that Jake was a married man. And it turns out that that wasn't just, you know, the basis to do some storylines on the wrestling television show. It was a source of tension for Jake Roberts, who attracted his share, to put it lightly, of female attention while on the road. And he tells you guys some stories about how hard it was for him to manage that female attention in the WWF with a wife at home. And in some ways, it kind of ties to Randy and Liz. So here's just an example of how hard it was at a time when these guys were such massive stars traveling the world all the time to convince the home front that everything was kosher and everybody was being faithful.
They had a girl from Playboy that stalked me for a while, and I wasn't even guilty, but in my wife's eyes I was, you know, because this girl kept showing up. Well, what's she doing there? And boom, and yeah. You know, I went to L.A. and did a show with Arsenio, and look in the audience, who sat in first row. She is. Well, my wife, I'd been at home, and she's like, you've got to go to L.A. to do Arsenio? Well, I better go with you because that's where that girl lives. I'm like, look, hey, I'm not fucking around with the girl, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to worry about it. Forget it. It's stupid. Why spend another $1,000 for an airline ticket? I'm going to fly out there. I'll be on the midnight plane coming back. Then I go out and get ready to do the skit on Arsenio, and I'm looking first row, there she is, knowing that my wife's at home watching that.
Oh.
And it didn't matter what I said to her. She did not believe me.
So, like, in terms of, like, Randy and Elizabeth, when you saw them together, were you thinking, like, oh, dear, this probably won't last?
Well, I watched my P's and Q's around them. Most guys didn't. You know, they just let whatever fly, let it fly. You know, the language was very abusive, and, you know, cunt this, cunt that. I mean, it was brutal, man. I mean, I wouldn't want my wife around that shit. And, you know, I had a couple of guys, the wife and I were very close to him and their wives, and here they'd be on the road screwing around right in front of my wife. I'm like, dude, are you serious? You know? What the fuck? And they're like, Well, tell your wife to keep her mouth shut. Great. Great. How about you keeping your dick in your fucking pants, or at least go to a different hotel or something, you know? I won't mention any names.
The visual of him looking in the audience at Arsenio, it's too late, you know? We're coast to coast. But at the same time, Evan, you got to wonder when you're talking to Jake, right? Like, infidelity is something that, you know, is very common for particularly wrestlers of his era. You know, you got to wonder, like, is he sort of, you know, playing around with whether something did happen there? Or at least is this story sort of like the one time that he was wrongfully accused? It was a lifelong saga for Jake in terms of, like, managing the home front. He ended up talking to you guys about that when you did the story on his personal challenges and how, you know, the road just consumed his any notion he had of keeping a marriage together. At least that's how it's how he tells it.
You know, hearing this, it makes me think about, you know, Beyond the Mat, of course, something that he obviously, I'm sure, is not stoked on, but, you know, classically. But Beyond the Mat, again, we've talked about a lot in this program in terms of, you know, so many of the people they identified for that documentary are super fascinating, you know, people. And Jake obviously is probably one of the more indelible parts of that doc. And when he talks about that very subject in the doc, he talks about how difficult it is, you know, for him being on the road from his, you know, of course, soul point of view about being on the road and, you know, trying to keep up the quote unquote excitement at home with all the things that are going on. You know, what is it? What's that line again? It's one girl and two girls with toys and, you know, or whatever.
And then he says, yeah, and then you're going to go home and try to make love to your wife. Ain't no way.
It's tough to say exactly, you know, where, you know, what really what happened, you know, with that story. But you know, I think Jake's also been pretty candid about, you know, these days, at least the things that took place on the road.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of it's just a funny kind of story. You know, these guys were absolutely surrounded by women all the time. And, yeah, good luck, you know, with a nuclear family, trying to keep that going. For Jake, it was upside real quick. It didn't take very long for him to be one of the more over characters in the WWF. The snake thing was an absolute smash. His ability to cut promos came through strong. Didn't have the greatest physique in the world for an era that was built around guys looking like superheroes. Very tall guy, lanky, good in the ring. But, you know, I think his look belied how successful he was because he just had so many other attributes in excess and in abundance that you really couldn't deny the guy, or at least we thought, because eventually if you grow this much as a heel in the WWF at this time period, eventually you're on a collision course with the Hulkster. Hulk Hogan, of course, is the main meal ticket in the business at the time, and if you can get a program with him, several matches, maybe get a couple of months worth of matches around the horn with him, you were going to make the most money that could be made in the business at the time, and maybe even adjusted for inflation, the most money you could ever make in the business. But as Jake talked about, he got just a taste of that, what it was like to work with Hulk Hogan, and it was snatched away from him. He was almost too popular. He worked Hulk Hogan December 30th, 1986 at a show in Providence, Rhode Island. He also worked him January 29th, 1987 in Providence, and then February 28th, 1987 in Winnipeg. And that is it for Jake Roberts versus Hulk Hogan. And here he talks to you guys, sort of laments the fact that it ended so prematurely.
I wasn't really on many of Hogan's shows. Usually my job was to get the next town ready for Hogan. So if he was wrestling in New York City, I was in L.A. And I was trying to make somebody a star out there so the next time Hogan's in L.A., he'd be wrestling the guy that just beat me in L.A. You know, that was my job, getting the guys ready for Hogan. Hogan used to tell me, I love it when you're on the card because I can go on early. What does that tell you? I was the only guy that could follow Hogan and take the show away from Hogan, you know, and very fortunate that I could do that. I mean, it cost me a lot of money because when they shot the angle for me and Hogan to wrestle each other, the reaction was not good. The reaction was DDT, DDT, not Hulk, Hulk, Hulk. You know, Vince looked right at me and goes, you're screwed. Can't have that. What do you mean? We wrestled in two markets, Providence, Rhode Island, and then in Montreal, and sold out both. You don't get no better than a sellout. But for Vince, it's not about that sellout. It's about marketing. And if they're chanting DDT, that's splitting our marketing, and we invested in Hogan, not in you. Wow, that hurts. And it cost me a shit ton of money. because the fans just did not buy Hogan beating me. That's crazy. But they believed in the DDT, and they believed my interviews, and it cost me money, man.
Yeah, he talks as much, Jason, about missed opportunities as he does, you know, his glory moments. You know, a lot of wrestlers, I think, will just wax nostalgic about their high points. But Jake is just as interested in putting on the table stuff like this, deep, abiding disappointments.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like to like kind of get it like that. And there's like so much that, like, you can learn from it. And I remember too, like, Evan and I were just such huge marks for the DDT. There's probably in those transcripts a lot of like questions about the DDT and the origin story like of it. But yeah, and I totally believe it. Like that, you know, the DDT was more over than Hogan.
Every time we've interviewed Jake, he's so open. You know, like he's so, like kind of what you were saying, Jack, he's so willing to just kind of open up right into the darkness, you know, and let you in on it. He doesn't shy away from telling those stories that are like super dark and right to the heart of the matter. He unloads on you, you know, he's very open in that way. And all the times I've interviewed him too, it's always been like super heavy. You know, he likes to get heavy. It's easy for him to get heavy with you. But that's something that, you know, obviously as a producer, director, it's like, you know, it's amazing. You're getting such great material from him because he is being so honest with you. And I remember in those early interviews too, when we're still trying to kind of figure out what the hell this show is, and just being like, wow, all of this stuff from him is so great. You know, like, wow, like, you know, just his delivery and how honest he is, because not everybody's super honest, you know, when they're doing interviews for this show. And he, you know, he is, whether he is his version of the truth, whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But in terms of like those emotions, I think those are real emotions, you know, that come through when he's talking about certain things. And nobody does it better, man, than he does.
Yeah. And I love too, like, hearing kind of like the backstage sort of workings of like a show, and how like, you know, someone like Hogan, like, you know, as soon as he's done his match, they're not sticking around for everyone else's matches. They're leaving and going, which I never thought about that, like, at all before. But just like how strategic sometimes the guys would be about like where they were, like, on the card if they had something going on that night, and like, you know, trying to get in there early so that
you got to get to Applebee's before it fucking closes.
Yeah.
You know.
He just has such a great way of explaining those mechanics of the business, where he's not dumbing it down, but he's giving you that peek behind the curtain, but he's putting it in terms that are so easy to understand and follow his train of thought. And that was a famous moment. He used to have a talk show segment in the vein of Piper's Pit called the Snake Pit. It was sort of like this big, like, foreboding Masters of the Universe looking set, like Skeletor or something. And he DDT'd Hogan right on the floor. And like he said, I mean, the immediate reaction was awesome. Someone stepping up to Hogan and planting him on his face, and couldn't have that.
You remember there was also that story about him like getting hit with the honky tonks like guitar, and it was supposed to be like a gimmick guitar, but it was like a real guitar.
Yeah, it's crushed his neck.
Yeah, and how like he told this like one specific detail about how like the fiberglass from the guitar stuck in his back, and for like a month when he was sleeping, like, it would just get caught on a sheet, like, and it would just be so painful.
Brutal.
Yeah, he's got that eye for detail, yeah. Man. He says things that you'd never forget, you know. Somebody else could have told you, honky-tonk smashed a guitar over my head and messed me up, but it's the glass and the sheet.
You know what's weird about that whole Hogan-Jake thing? It's like, something, man, did they take for granted, you know, because wouldn't they kill for something as monumental as that could have been, right? They have the, you know, just this Hulk in, like, you know, in abundance, and we got all these big name stars, and now it's like, how many years have they been hungry for something like that could have legs like that, you know? And it's crazy that they would not get into a program, because that would have been huge.
JP, you're well acquainted with Hulkamania. I mean, Hulk versus Jake in 86, 87. May I have more, please?
It always is a thing that disappoints me that never happened. And it was just so money and idea. Because, you know, here's the thing. The DDT, you know, we're talking about it before. It's, and I remember, you know, back in the, before it became everybody's, you know, everybody's transition move, It was like the move. It's like my friends who were casual wrestling fans, because I was a wrestling fan, they were like, that could kill you.
Mm-hmm.
That could kill you. And it's like, that's the money thing. And the idea that you have a move that maybe could, you know, quote unquote, kill Hulk Hogan. It's just money, money, money being printed.
Or the fans were just dying to see what would happen if Hogan was hit with that adversity.
I always had this fantasy in my mind, like, you know, as a kid with the toys and stuff, that Jake would be the one person. So Hogan would Hulk up, throw Jake into the ropes. He'd go for the boot. But because Jake was so smart, he ducked the boot, went behind Hogan, kicked him, DDT, and pinned him.
So much for you working for the booking committee back then.
Yeah, not happening.
But I mean, your disappointment there is in Jake too. And here in this this final piece of sound from the interview, Jake talks about looking back on his career and kind of this arbitrary yanking away of opportunity that cuts the deepest when you reflect back on a career like he's had. And he talked about this in the context of, he takes it to a fascinating place. He talks about this disappointment in the context of why so many wrestlers from his generation met untimely deaths.
My theory on why so many died is pretty simple. In my era, there were so many of us that had invested their whole life into it. And we had worked so hard to get to that point. Unlike today. I'm not saying the guys don't work hard, but we had spent years developing characters and stuff. And you finally make it to the big dance and you're going along fine. But then all of a sudden, for seems like no reason at all, they get bored with you. Or they're tired of writing for you. Or they can't think of something else. Or they're ready to just change gears and go a different direction. And you're tossed out the fucking door. Wait a minute. There's really only one company. Come on. And there's no way back. So here's my whole dream, my whole life has been taken away from me. And I'm still physically able to do the job, mentally able to do the job. It's just that you don't like me, whatever, you know, and it's taken away from you and you're sent home. And now you're at home going, what the fuck do I do? I don't know how to do anything else, or I don't want to do anything else, or this is what I live and I eat and I breathe. To get to the point where I was at, you got to know a lot of shit, man. You got to have your shit down. And you've invested, you know, your whole fucking life doing this. So when it's taken away from you, depression. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? And then it's compounded because sooner or later you're going to run out of money. When you start running out of money, there's pressure from the wife or pressure from the family or, Daddy, what are you going to do now? Daddy, are you really going to work at 7-Eleven or selling donuts? How humiliating is that? Hey, man, what are you doing selling donuts, man? What the fuck, you know, or 7-Eleven or whatever, or Home Depot. What the fuck? You used to be a star, man. What happened? What did you do wrong? I didn't do anything wrong, man. And guys go off the deep end, man. I don't want to live no more. They don't feel alive anymore, man. It's incredible the high you get performing in front of people. You know, thousands of people, or it doesn't matter if it's thousands, it could be 50 people. You get that adrenaline rush, it's unlike no other, man. That's the most incredible high you can have. And for that to be taken away from you, it's crippling. One of my stints in a rehab, the psychiatrist told me, he said, I'm not worried about you ODing on something. He says, the problem with you is going to be adrenaline. There's going to become a time where you won't be able to get that because you physically won't be able to go out and do it anymore. And that is so true. Man, when your body can't go no more and it's taken away from you, You don't feel like you're worth anything anymore, man. Your self-worth is on what you did. And to get out of that is damn near impossible.
Uncomfortable truth spoken there by a snake man. Jason, any closing thoughts? I'm so grateful that you guys were able to get this these things on the record and preserved from Jake the Snake Roberts, particularly at a time, like I said earlier, where he was, you know, really kind of clear in his ability to carry a tune for a while and really convey these thoughts. I mean, so much to chew on there.
He puts it so eloquently. Like when he talks about like that adrenaline rush and the addiction to the adrenaline, like I always think, especially, you know, with another WrestleMania coming up, like in the Randy Savage episode, he talks about WrestleMania 3 and like coming out. And when they had like the little rings for their entrance and he comes out with Alice Cooper, and he said he can feel the electricity like in the arena. Like it's like literally making the hairs on the back of his neck like stand up. And he said that he told us that even Alice Cooper like felt it, like that energy so much. And because like Alice Cooper is like usually in control of the audience when he is performing, at this, in this case, he wasn't in control of it. And like the power of the energy in the arena literally knocked him out. Like he said, he like passed out and that Jake was like hoisting him up, like holding him up until he like came to again. And so I can only imagine I can't even imagine like what that feeling must be like. And then to like experience that, like so much, and so much of who you are and your identity is like tied to that. And then for it to be like taken away from you. I find that like super fascinating, and I can relate to it in my own career, working in the film industry as well too. And so, you know, to see like where he has come now since like all of this and like how, well he's doing like now compared to how he was doing like a decade or two ago, is really something. And that, you know, he's been able to live like a longer life than a lot of his like peers. But I like his like explanation as to like how a lot of his like friends have gone. And, it's like really, yeah, that's like, it's really, it's real stuff.
I think he's right on the money, you know, with that. I mean, nobody would know that better, I think, than he has with so many close brushes with death himself. But that powerful withdrawal, you know, of what do you do when you're not, when you're no longer in the spotlight, and getting addicted to that feeling, that rush, that adrenaline from the crowd. And you are, as a wrestler, commanding the crowd, or a good wrestler, you know, you are commanding the crowd, you're commanding the response from the audience, especially if, even more so if you're a heel, you know. So I think trying to live a regular life outside of that experience is incredibly difficult. I mean, we hear stories about it in Hollywood when people are, you know, when all the silent stars were being aged out by the talkies, you know, it created a lot of really dark shit, you know, in the industry. And I think it's very similar with this. And I think it's kind of the cruelest part of the wrestling business is just that cycle of exploitation, you know, the idea of just sending people out there. You know, we're the puppet masters who are controlling the fate of these individuals who go out there and punish their body beyond any physical limits that they should be, you know, getting in car accidents every night, you know, so we can draw the money and we can make the money and we can make the decisions. And it's this very, there is a way you can look at all of this as a really sick and disturbing exploitation of humanity. Really, honestly, you can. And I think you can draw a line.
And guys get drug dependencies, and then you say, oh, it's the drugs that cost him the opportunity. Right. But it turns out that the drugs was the only thing he could turn to replicate the void.
Yes.
The void. Imagine being looked at by 80,000 people as a god in Pontiac, Michigan for a fleeting moment. What's the next day like after everyone looks at you like a god?
Exactly. And then having to be at 7-Eleven or whatever, working or wherever, you know, it would be impossible to do that. It's like, it kind of reminds me of some of the themes we explored for the Brawl for All episode too. It's like, we're just going to send people out, you know, in harm's way and like, you know, for the expense of what exactly, you know? And so, yeah, that is the dark side, for lack of a better term, of all of this is that exactly.
I hope we never stop hearing from Jake the Snake Roberts on Dark Side of the Ring, but let this episode here of Unheard stand as a document to some of the more probing insights that he's offered to your cameras over the years. So that'll do it for us this week on the program. Do join us every Wednesday when new episodes of Dark Side of the Ring Unheard drop, focusing, of course, on an interview from the Dark Side Archives. So many legends, so many hours and hours of tape to sift through, and we very much appreciate you joining us for the ride. And again, tune in to the latest episode of Dark Side of the Ring on Vice TV Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It'll be a look at sensational Sherry Martell. For now and for us, it's back to the vault, and we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring, Unheard.